Hello, and welcome to the Rooted in Reliability podcast, your plant performance podcast, where we dive deeper into asset management techniques and know-how. I'm your host, James Kovacic, and I will be your guide to achieving industry best practice. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is here to provide you with the insights to improve plant performance and deliver bottom-line results to your organization. In case you missed the last episode, you can find the Rooted in Reliability podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and on the reliability.fm network. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Now let's dive into today's topic. It is my pleasure to welcome back Heinz Block to the podcast. Welcome back, Heinz.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, Heinz, for those that may not be familiar with you, you are an expert, a legend in the field of rotating equipment, pumps, compressor, oil mist lubrication, all those great things. A little bit of background on yourself. You have both a BS, MS in mechanical engineering from the New Jersey Institute of Technology.
Yes, that's correct.
You served with ExxonMobil for over 24 years as a machinery specialist. Since then, you have also been recognized by three major societies. You're a founding member on the board of Texas A&M University International Pump User Symposium, a life fellow with ASME, and you maintain your professional engineer in both New Jersey and Texas. You have also been granted 7 patents in improving equipment for improving equipment reliability, and you're a frequent author, and those books include Pump Wisdom, Pump User Handbook Life Extension, Maximizing Machinery Uptime 5th Edition, Process Plant Improvement, and Improving Machinery Reliability. Now, that was a very brief bio to yourself, but did I miss anything big you want to cover?
No, that's fine. We're really ready to answer some of your questions. And my particular interest has been in 5 failure modes that are prevalent in process pumps.
Excellent. Now, for these 5 failure modes, what have you seen implemented to address these? Is it proper design specifications, proper engineering upfront? Is it a maintenance program? Is it a combination of the two?
All of these are of great importance, and it really starts with a person who has enough exposure, prior exposure, or enough experience, or who has the ability on a theoretical basis to take whatever time is needed to properly specify the pump, to properly look at the design layout so that one knows that the pressure that is needed on the pump that I am about to select, that I have in the back of my mind, that I have on my bidders list and am about to purchase, I need to now, before I actually purchase that pump, verify that my systems designer is giving me enough pressure, or that from a physical layout point, let me just use this as another possibility, from a physical layout point, if I have pump installed below the surface that I'm walking on, below ground, so to speak, in pit, well, then, of course, also the pressure is much higher than if I have a system where that pump is located horizontally, flat on the ground. If I put it into a pit, if I buy a pump, and I'm not advocating that, I'm simply using it as an example, but if I buy a vertical pump, I very often do this as a designer and as an experienced engineer in order to provide enough suction pressure. The suction pressure, which comes maybe from a vessel, process vessel, that is presently mounted 5 feet above ground. If I put my pump 10 feet below ground, then by definition, I have 15 feet of pressure. And a PSI is related to a certain amount of feet of head. To be exact, when we're dealing with water, 2.31 feet of water equals 1 PSI. So if I know what the PSI or NPSH in head, in feet, is required for the pump I'm about to select, then I know whether I have to really dig a pit in the ground or whether I can put that pump directly on the surface that I'm walking on. But that's just arbitrary example. I'm simply highlighting here the absolute necessity of communicating or communication to exist between the person who selects the pump and the person who designs the process. These two must communicate, and if they don't, these issues can creep up very frequently.
Yes, absolutely. That constant communication, that information is vital to picking the right piece of equipment for that process.
That is correct. And so the next thing is, of course, now that we have an understanding that I have to buy a pump that has a certain NPSH required by definition, simply because the impeller is made in a certain manner, now I have to ascertain that that's the pump that my purchasing agent is buying. He doesn't have the liberty or the freedom to buy whatever pump is offered to him and which claims to be in a pressure generation or delta P range, or which claims to be in a certain flow range. He needs to buy the pump that I'm specifying because I have spent my time in verifying that it has adequate NPSH margin between what is available and what the pump needs. That prevents low flow in the future. And so we already are now establishing the fact that the selecting engineer, the machinery engineer, cannot operate just by himself and divorce himself from the process people. Likewise, the process people cannot divorce themselves from the machinery engineer. The two have to cooperate, or else we have bought the wrong pump to begin with.
Yes.
The second thing, James, is that while we're still in that area that you're referring to here, very frequently, we need a pump. Let me just say arbitrarily, this has to be a pump for a process. In order for the process to run properly at 100% throughput, this is a 1,000 gallon per minute pump. Well, somebody else says, no, maybe we need a little bit more. So he says, let's buy it for 1,200 gallons per minute. And somebody else says, well, if we ever expand the plant, we would be well off by having that pump maybe 1,800 gallons per minute, even though today we only need 1,000. Well, that's a huge mistake, because if you purchase something that is too big to begin with, then you run into the problem where I have drawn this analogy with the automobile. If I purchase a tire for an automobile that is substantially too thick or is extending past the vehicle itself, then I run into certain difficulties or have to make certain compromises that were previously not foreseen. And we don't even have to go into that. An automobile is built ideally for a tire in the so-and-so size range, and you may be able to go slightly larger with that tire within close limits, or you may even be able to go in the opposite direction and buy the tire a tiny bit narrower. But immediately you know that if you buy the narrower tire, it has a footprint that is loaded up by the total weight of the car, and it will be loaded up to a slightly higher point because we've bought it somewhat narrower. So what's the advantage? Well, you can go faster. You can instead of going only 115 miles per hour with the vehicle, which you shouldn't have been doing in the first place, you can actually go 120 miles per hour because the friction that that particular tire has relative to the road, that's a tiny bit less. But, of course, it has other vulnerabilities. So be this as it may, purchasing something that is too large, purchasing a fluid machine that is too large, that is one of the mistakes that I see in the process area.
Excellent. And that is a great caution. I understand many designers want to incorporate that future state, but there's a whole lot that goes into that. And like you said, you can't go too big. There might be a little window you might be able to increase in, but not oversized dramatically.
Everything we do, you're correct. Everything we do is, of course, a compromise. And go ahead. You're asking the question.
No, go ahead. What is the? I'm more interested to hear this compromise.
I wanted to move to the next one and explain compromise as we look at the second item that we had on our list of five. The second item was lubrication inadequacy. And I spent much time on oil rings, but now that we can revisit that, let me just tell you that these oil rings are usually designed in terms of their width, their weight, their diameter, designed to operate best in ISO grade 32 oil. Now, is ISO grade 32 mineral oil the best oil for a pump when that pump operates in one of the southern states in the United States? And the answer is no, that an ISO grade 32 oil is a little bit too thin to operate when we have ambient temperatures here of 100 degrees over several weeks. The oil that is 32 ISO grade is too thin in the sense that as you now operate the pump and the oil gets a little bit warmer, that oil will become thinner. And now when it becomes even thinner, you're going to have metal-to-metal contact because as the rolling elements are trying to rotate around the races and you now encounter a lubricant that has an inadequate film strength, or even film thickness, because it's ISO grade 32, when in fact, ideally, you should have used 68, that is a vulnerability. However, you put this in perspective. I have already said that most of these oil rings are designed for ISO grade 32. Why? Because ISO grade 32 is used in conjunction with 99% of all the sleeve bearings that you normally find in fluid machinery in the petrochemical industry or in the process industry. In other words, I have made my initial comment where I said ISO grade 32 is inadequate in strength. You should have a thicker oil. That all referred to rolling element bearings. So it also explains now that when I have rolling element bearings, I should perhaps use a thicker oil. But if I use a thicker oil, then as I get thicker and thicker with my oil, the oil ring will refuse to turn at a certain RPM. It will slow down. Just visualize in your mind that instead of lube oil, we're using honey or molasses. Well, it doesn't take very much imagination for us to convince ourselves that the oil ring gets stuck. It'll not turn because you're trying to run it in molasses. Well, lube oils are not molasses, but a thicker lube oil is going towards honey or towards molasses. And so now I have to ask myself, is an oil ring really the proper lubrication or lubricant application mode? Should we not, in some cases, use different oil application modes? For instance, one can apply the oil with a circulating system, quite obviously. That's done in large compressors, 10,000 horsepower, 100,000 horsepower compressors, steam turbines. They apply oil not with slinger rings or oil rings. They apply the oil by spraying it in, by having an auxiliary system that pumps the oil around. Of course, we can't afford to do that on our 50 horsepower process pump, but what we can do with our 50 horsepower process pump, we can certainly ask ourselves if a disc that dips in the oil wouldn't be more appropriate than an oil ring that dips in the oil. And so those are facts. European pump manufacturers for many, many decades have used discs. One American manufacturer, Roth Pumps, R-O-T-H, of course they're not the biggest pump company, but they are using these discs and not these oil rings. So this is what I just wanted to mention in conjunction with what can be done, what has to be done when we deal with lube inadequacies. We're also at a point in time when the use of pure mineral oils is not appropriate in your average process pump. You should use a synthetic lubricant. A synthetic lubricant ISO grade 32, which will allow you to use these oil rings, that has the same lube oil film strength or oil film thickness as a mineral oil 68. So we said ideally we would use a mineral oil 68, but we can't because the oil rings don't run right. However, if we use a synthetic oil 32 that has the film strength equivalent to, and it has the lubrication characteristics equivalent to, a mineral oil 68. So we should go with synthetic 32. We should get the point across to our administrators that that oil costs significantly more than a mineral oil. Synthetic oils cost more than mineral oils. And therefore, we should really protect the lube oil sump or bearing housing, protect it against the intrusion of dirt, dust, water vapor, and so forth. And so now we need bearing protectors, and they cost money. And these bearing protectors, depending on where you buy them from and depending on how they are designed, you can buy good ones and you can buy bad ones. But you buy them in order to protect this expensive synthetic lube oil from degrading prematurely due to dirt intrusion, and you now have the best of all worlds, and that's how we are dealing with issue number three, or issue number two it was, which had to do with lube inadequacies. Use the right lube oil, protect the lube oil, and if need be, get rid of oil rings, or at an absolute minimum, mandatory, if you use oil rings, you better be sure that they are properly designed, that they do not go out of round, and that they are properly fabricated.
Yes, absolutely.
This podcast is brought to you by Iridicio. Be sure to check out Iridicio's IBL Blended Learning for Maintenance and Reliability Professionals. This SMRP-accredited project-based curriculum will take you through all aspects of a maintenance and reliability program and provides you with all the tools you need to generate a 30 times return on investment for your organization and a set of credentials from the University of Tennessee for you. You can find out more at ibltraining.com.
So if you're ready to go to point three, we dealt with sealing issues. I have a few maybe points to add to sealing issues. I believe firmly that, I understand the financial incentive in terms of initial costs by having some kind of an alliance with a certain particular mechanical seal manufacturer. But I believe that when you have an alliance with a seal manufacturer, you have to really put together a highly detailed specification of deliveries or points that are mandatory or deliverables is perhaps a better word. Mandatory deliverables. One of the deliverables from the company with whom you have a seal alliance is that that company is being rewarded on the basis of you having fewer and fewer seal-related outages. And that should be an alliance which is predicated on the assumption that this particular alliance partner is also in some cases saying, I'm sorry, Company X, I don't really build the absolute best seal for the so-and-so pump service, but since I'm being rewarded on the basis of giving you seals that have the greatest life expectancy, the least frequent seal replacement need, I am going to purchase seal type so-and-so from seal manufacturer XYZ, and I'm going to install that in your pumping service such and such. There are some manufacturers, seal manufacturers, that agree to that kind of contract, those kinds of deliverables. And there are a few sophisticated pump users who insist on that and reap the benefits of seeing to it that a partnership exists on the basis of ultimately, the one who foots the bill, which is me as a purchaser, me as a petrochemical plant, is going to benefit in terms of seeing fewer and fewer seal failures. The unfortunate thing today is that very often these partnerships are going to be formed by having an intense involvement by the purchasing agent. And that purchasing agent knows only two things, cost and delivery. And if you purchase based on cost and delivery, you will not, in the best of class plant, be on the best of class list for very long. You must, if you're a best of class plant, you must have the best components, the components that live the longest, and the maintenance procedures that are least frequent and that are most effective. And that, of course, entails training of the personnel. So you make that seal manufacturer, you make that seal partner, you make them your reliability improvement partners. You make them your technology provider and trainer. They have to train your people in how to see to it that you have longest possible seal life. What is the difference between different types of seals? And that gets us to a repetition to some extent, because item number four in terms of these failure frequencies or failure modes was bearing issues. I was able to give you considerable detail when we first talked about bearing issues, but I want to reiterate that you have to buy your bearings from a provider who, every time you need bearings, lets you have access to an application engineer. An application engineer is not just a salesman. An application engineer is selling on the basis of explaining to you that you should upgrade your bearing selection. And where you previously used XYZ configuration or style bearings, you should in the future use ABCD type bearings, whatever that means. And you pay for that application engineering know-how by purchasing from not the lowest bidder, but by purchasing from a manufacturer, a bearing manufacturer, a bearing vendor, who gives you the full information as to what to apply for greatest life expectancy and highest reliability, and where they have been doing that before, and why spending so and so much for a bearing but having far, far fewer outages is the way to go. That's information you get from an application engineer. You will not get that information from someone who simply sells bearings. So if you don't mind, we'll go and take a look at the last one. One could talk about the last one, which was alignment and installation defects and generally frequent maintenance requirements. Some of that is, of course, explained in some of the books that I had written over the years. And let me put it this way. We have highly limited time right now in communicating about that. It's, of course, impossible for me, having worked in this industry for 65 years, to download everything that I have learned about pumps in just 1 hour. One can't do that. But what is being done in best-of-class companies, they will actually, in a best-of-class company, have a provision, a training provision, where the section supervisor or department head for maintenance is going to hand the individual technician a book. And the book may cost $25 or $50, which is absolute peanuts if that's a book that really explains why a certain pump or a certain configuration leaves you risky and vulnerable. If as a result of reading that book, which perhaps has 200 pages, you avoid even a single failure, then you could prove that the amount of time you spend in buying that book and reading that book, that has been paid back 100 times by just avoiding one failure, which was explained on page 78 or whatnot. And if you pay attention to that, you will not have that failure again on the certain pump where previously you have had three failures in a period of 2 years or whatnot. And in a good plant, and this is now, again, my entire point, I don't want you to lose sight of what is my point. My point is, when I provide a book of this type and put it into the hands of a certain mechanic, machinist, technician, and I talk to him and say, this book has 200 pages, And of these 200 pages, 100 of them are taken up by illustrations and photos. And you are working, I would say to this gentleman, you are working on in a given year only 200 work days. The rest is weekends, the rest is vacations, or the rest is training time and whatnot, or you're out sick. 200 days per year is what you work. And this book has 100 pages. That means that in a two-day period, I'm asking you to read one page. If you can't do that, Mr. Mechanic, reporting to me, if I find out that you don't have the time, quote-unquote, to read a half a page in this book and to implement it and to see to it that you've absorbed what this book says about how to improve reliability of pumps, then, quite frankly, a year from now, I will find another job for you. And if the technician says, what kind of job will you find for me? I'll say to him, well, you're going to unload equipment, or you're going to put bales of synthetic rubber that we produce in the elastomeric unit. You will put those on trucks. And, you know, the hourly rate for people who do that is substantially below the hourly rate that we presently pay you. In other words, I would, as a competent supervisor or manager, I would upgrade the ability of the people who work for me. And I would do that in the manner that I've just explained to you. I would do it by insisting that they read that stuff, because all that stuff, quote unquote, has been published before ad infinitum. But it will be of no use unless we have someone pick up that book and read it. And I would make them pick up that book and read it by telling them beforehand that a year from today, they're going to be aced, they're going to be tested, because I, as a good engineer supervisor or as a good department head, I will know what it says when I open up and it says pumps should really be preferably installed on monolithic blocks, pre-filled base plates, epoxy pre-filled base plates. I will find a way a year from today to sit down with this employee and to hear him out and to figure out whether he has really read this or whether he hasn't read it. That's how it's done in best of class companies. And unless one does that, you can talk until you're blue in the face. And reliability will be talked about. It's going to be a hot air issue, which will be talked about ad infinitum and will never be implemented unless one does what we have now in this 1 hour just touched on, just barely touched on.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And the other thing I found that helps with the installation assembly issues is having good repeatable procedures. That way everyone's doing it the same way. If an issue is encountered, we can go back and see where those procedures may have missed something, or if someone didn't follow the procedure. It helps to provide that consistency and repeatability regardless of which mechanic may be doing that work.
Exactly. And these procedures and work processes are in many cases written by teams of two or three people. They get paid for that because I make them sit down and I ask them in the next 3 days, would you spend some of your time? I pay you overtime, but you three guys sit down and in 3 days, 2 hours overtime on three consecutive days, you're going to produce a procedure which on one side of the sheet says how to properly install a coupling, or on the other side, how to properly remove a coupling. And in that procedure, you have steps one through whatever number, and you sign it at the bottom. And you sign it, Mr. A, Mr. B, Mr. C, and you sign it. It was done on the 15th of October of the year 2018. And if you ever think of having to revise it, then you go and revise it, and you get paid a small amount of extra time because item 17 or paragraph 17, where you had previously said the interference fit should be a half a thousandth, you're going to open it up again, and in your revision you say the interference fit should be 2,000th for whatever reason, and you sign it and you say revised by Mr. A, Mr. B, Mr. C on the 17th of January of the year 2019. And you get paid for it, but you have ownership for that procedure. That procedure is one that's been devised by you, and you're going to revise it and keep it up along these lines. And that's how it's done in best of class companies. And then these procedures are handed out during what we call shirt sleeve seminars, which is a separate subject clearly described in some of my books. And these shirt sleeve seminars then are done by someone rolling up their sleeves, spending 6 minutes at the end of a safety session and discussing, perhaps as we just said, how to put couplings on shafts and how to remove couplings from shafts, or what are the different bearings that we have in different pumps and why is this bearing different from that bearing, and how do these bearings function. And 6 minutes, laminated in plastic, handed out to everybody and put into 3-ring binders. And this is how one actually physically upgrades an entire organization and moves it from being in the first, maybe in the bottom decile of the chain of achievement to the top decile of the people who have achieved the most or the plans that are most profitable. So one could go on and on in any of that, but hopefully if somebody acts on what we have now discussed, they will prosper. I believe that firmly, and I think you do too.
Absolutely. Now, Heinz, I want to thank you for taking the time today to talk to us about the 5 top failures that you see within pumps, and then also what we can do about these. But before you go, where can people find out more about you, any adventure activities that you may be at? Where can they find a listing of your books? Those sorts of things.
All right. Good question. A listing of the books, if they wanted to have that, I believe I've sent you something that you could pass on to them. It's actually a listing of the well over 300 or 400 papers, conference papers that have been written by me over the past several decades. And at the bottom of it, there are the 20 books that I have written. Some of them have been translated into languages such as Spanish, Portuguese, Russian. Others are only available in English, but there are 45 different editions of these 20 books. And I would simply go and advocate that they purchase some of these books, one of them perhaps from Amazon.com. But James, you make available to them the list that I sent you. They should buy it from Amazon.com. And the cost will be less than $50 per book. And I am intimately familiar with what it costs to repair the average pump here in the Gulf Coast of Texas and Alabama. The answer is $10,267. So your payback, if somebody figures out what goes wrong with pumps and he finds the solution to it in a $50 book, the payback is humongous. So this is what I would advocate for the time being. Of course, I'm often speaking at SMRP meetings. For instance, tomorrow I will be in Galveston, SMRP, Society of Maintenance and Reliability Professionals. In late September, or actually it's mid-September, I will be at Texas A&M, and I will do a tutorial which deals with a seal issue that happened. But I have written these books and these articles in the hope that people will pick them up and will educate themselves. It should be fairly easy to do that. Okay?
Excellent. And I will also provide a link to all these resources you mentioned and to your own website, heinzblock.com, where they can find those published papers, the best practices, all those other great things about you. So thank you for taking the time today to talk to us about pump failures. I know it's something that plagues a lot of people, and we can fix it. We can stop it from happening. So thank you again for sharing your vast knowledge on this topic with us today.
Thank you, and you're very welcome. And perhaps we will re-encounter each other on some other occasion in the future.
Yes.
Thanks again, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
I would like to thank you for listening and remind you that you can always find out more on maintenance, reliability, and asset management at www.iridicio.com and by following our blog. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is a proud member of the Reliability.fm network. I'd like to ask you to please rate and review this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. It ensures the podcast stays relevant and is easy to find by like-minded professionals. It is only with your ratings and reviews that the Rooted in Reliability podcast can continue to grow. I thank you for providing this small but critical support. We'll see you next week when we dive into another burning topic with Rooted in Reliability, your plant performance podcast.